Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
Well, the big news of the week, of course, was the historic meeting in Singapore between US President Donald Trump and North Korean Supreme Leader Chairman Kim Jong-un to discuss the denuclearization of North Korea and many other things. As one of the newspapers, news organizations in the United States put it quite eloquently today, Donald Trump was selling Kim the American dream. That's a very interesting way of putting it, because there wasn't in the communique a lot more substance than that. And there was that very curious, almost propaganda film that Donald Trump made about the bright new future, almost as if he was trying to out-propagandize one of the great propagandists of all time, North Korea. Well, both leaders came away from the meeting proclaiming it a success, but there isn't any actual agreement yet on nuclear weapons, and the only firm decision seems to be an undertaking by the US to end regular war games off the coast. They're going to talk about denuclearization, and that's certainly the aim, but it's certainly not achieved yet, and the Trump administration was saying, well, maybe it'll be achieved by the end of this term of presidency, leaving you a little bit with the impression that he'll try to ride the coattails of success there into another term in office, which means, yes, is it as much about Donald Trump's future as about peace on the North Korean peninsula? It probably is, you know. Well, an end to the hostilities between North Korea and the West, in particular the US, is certainly a good thing. There's no doubt about that. But there is an aspect that has not been addressed properly, and it needs to be, and that's the shocking human rights abuses that are going on inside North Korea. Now, former Australian High Court Judge Michael Kirby says there can't be peace on the Korean Peninsula as long as human rights abuses continue in North Korea. And he should know, Judge Kirby chaired a United Nations probe into human rights abuses in North Korea that wrapped up in 2014. His report was on behalf of the UN Security Council. It documented a litany of the most dreadful crimes by that government against their own people, including extermination, murder, enslavement, torture, imprisonment, rape, forced abortions and other sexual violence, and persecution on political, religious, racial and gender grounds. That's from the report. Well, Justice Michael Kirby, welcome to Open House.
Thank you for having me.
Peace on the peninsula will be a good thing. Denuclearization is always a good aim, but it's about far more than that, isn't it?
Well, it is. At the very core of the problem are two really difficult issues: getting rid of the nuclear weapons and improving radically the human rights situation in North Korea. And both of those are interconnected, and you can't really get progress if you don't deal with both of them.
Would it be too cynical to take the view of what happened this week, that here was a man who, like his family members before him, built his arsenal, pointed them at America, made threats, and then found himself on the world stage negotiating, whereas normally he would be being pursued for his human rights abuses at home?
Yes, he must be sitting up in bed this morning, scratching his head and wondering how it all happened. Because until now, the United States, under different administrations, has been absolutely strict that a precondition to any negotiations would be complete, verifiable and irreversible denuclearization. And instead of that, the agreement in the four-part joint declaration is that North Korea will work towards denuclearization. So it's a much softer obligation than what has been the unanimous view of the United States until now.
Nevertheless, so do you take the view that Donald Trump and the administration of the United States have achieved a breakthrough, or do you take the view that they have opened the door for other despots in the future to use similar means?
Well, I do take the view that it's a good thing that they have had talks, because we're talking about the issue of nuclear weapons, which are not just a big bomb. They are hugely destructive of the human species, of the human environment, of the food chain, and it's therefore a somewhat formalistic approach to it, to play no speaks and to have no dialogue. But the dialogue is not as important as the actions, and the actions are very, very vague in the four-point joint declaration, and there's no real mention, there's no mention in the declaration of human rights of the people of North Korea, and that was the subject of the Commission of Inquiry of the Human Rights Council that I chaired in 2013-14.
Yes, well, let's go to that. That's the main reason we wanted to speak with you, because human rights have not been mentioned on the agenda, and they ought. How bad was the situation when you conducted your inquiry, and do you have a sense of how it's fared since then?
Well, it was very bad, and in fact, not just my opinion, but the report of the Commission was so shocking to the United Nations that many countries who normally hold back from condemning others were really in a state of shock when the report came out, and the votes in the Human Rights Council, followed by the votes in the General Assembly, were huge, because it came as a terrible revelation to the international community. And then, moreover, the report was, as we had recommended, sent to the Security Council, which only once before, in the case of Burma, had taken on a report relating to human rights. So, it was a very strong reaction of the international community, and I think that laid the ground for the permanent five, including China and the Russian Federation, to agree to the increasing of the sanctions on North Korea, which is apparently one of the main factors that has put pressure on Kim. Now, has it improved? There's no real evidence that it has improved, and all the evidence, including, by the way, the murder of family members of Kim Jong-un, they all seem to indicate that it's just the same, and therefore that the problem that was revealed in the Commission of Inquiry report remains to be dealt with.
And that problem includes political prisoners, basic decency and dignity like access to food, travel restrictions, discrimination of many kinds. Can you paint a picture of what life is like for the average, if there is such a thing, the average North Korean?
The fundamental problem is the problem of food. They had a control economy, like the controlled economies of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. And that meant people got coupons, like I remember from the wartime in Australia. I mean, Mr. Menzies got rid of them in 1951, but they were still operating in North Korea. But then that controlled economy really broke down, and the net result of it was that women were setting up stalls in town squares to sell whatever was saleable in order to get cash in a market economy from which they could feed their families. And many, mostly women, were escaping into China across the frozen rivers during the winter period and trying to escape into South Korea down the escape lines in China. The situation for the ordinary person is dire, in addition to the problems for human rights that you mentioned, there's the fact that there's just no real political freedom. There's no availability of the internet. There is an intranet, but there's no connection to the outside world. They don't really know what the outside world makes of them. They don't know of the report of the United Nations Commission of Inquiry, and they are forced to watch programs which are out-and-out propaganda. And in our report, we didn't call for regime change, because they are a member of the United Nations and we were a body of the United Nations. Mm-hmm. But we insisted that they had to make radical changes in their system of government in order to meet the minimum standards of human rights, which are one of the three objectives of the United Nations system.
Yes. Our guest on Open House is the man who led that United Nations inquiry, the Honourable former Justice, retired Judge Michael Kirby. So in the months to come, as they start talking about denuclearisation, if human rights was to be put on the agenda, could you imagine what the pathway might look like? Where would you start?
Well, there's a bit of an obstacle, quite an obstacle, at the very outset, because one of the recommendations in our report was that steps should be taken to refer the case of North Korea to a prosecutor at the International Criminal Court. So that wouldn't be palatable to the present regime. In fairness, Kim Jong-un has only been in power for the last 5 years or so, and therefore he is not personally responsible for most of the horrible crimes that were committed in the past. But there's a principle in international law called the command principle, and it states that if you are in command of agencies of the state and you don't use your power in order to stop crimes against humanity and provide redress against crimes against humanity, then you can yourself be held liable for that. So that's an obstacle in the path at the very beginning, and that would have to be addressed. How deep do you dig into the wrongs in order to provide a transparent redress? But the first thing that should be done, we all agreed on our commission that the first thing we would want to see done was the opening up of the detention camps, because some people said they contained 1 million people. Our view on the information we could get was that it was probably something more like 150,000 people.
Right.
And this would be not only the person who is accused, mostly of political disloyalty to the regime.
Yes.
That's mostly. But the system in North Korea is not only to imprison the person suspected of political disloyalty, but also their family, their parents, and their children, because they are a contagion of disloyalty in the country that has to be simply removed, and
yes,
that's what they
yes
do. So they denied that they have these camps, but unfortunately for them, we now have Google Earth and we've got military satellites, and the images that were identified in the places where some of the escapees had been as detainees were so accurate and so clear and so similar to the descriptions, including in the layout of the camp, that it really is impossible to deny it. But the first step that should be taken, in my opinion, is for North Korea to allow verification, to allow independent experts.
Well, yes, because I gather you of course, had your movements were very limited as a commission of inquiry, and that became a bit of an issue. So as these months progress, what role should the United Nations play?
Well, I think the United Nations should play a big role. So far, it's just been the United States of America and North Korea. You look at the four-point agreement, it's entirely devoted to those two countries.
Yes.
But this is a danger to the region. It's a specific danger to Japan, but it's also a danger, a huge danger, to the people in South Korea. And they've been living for the last a couple of years in a state of great and reasonable fear. There's a really urgent problem, and the problem has perhaps been advanced a little on the way to a solution by the meeting between President Trump and Chairman Kim. But there's so much left to be done, and I think it's just premature to be rejoicing in a self-declared triumph until you've actually seen some real miles of evidence that progress has been made in within North Korea. We didn't get into North Korea, though we never expected to get into North Korea, but we had tons of evidence because there were 30,000 refugees in South Korea from North Korea, and they all wanted to come along and tell their story. In fact, we had to cut them off because otherwise we wouldn't have got our report done in the 6 months that we were effectively given.
Well, you're talking years and decades to come of work to be done in North Korea if it's to return to the sort of nation that Kim says he wants it to be. I mean, that's the interesting thing. What do you make of him? He says that now that he wants to leave the past behind. Well, your description can show perhaps why he would say that with such vehemence. Sadly, Donald Trump said exactly the same thing. But there does need to be a reconciliation of all of that. But what do you make of Kim himself? Do you think he's different from his forebears?
I don't know more about Kim Jong-un than I read in the newspapers and hear on other media. In fact, he is a bit different, self-evidently, because part of his education was in Switzerland. Mm. So he spent formative years of his life in an absolutely different country from his own country, and he's gone back there from Switzerland and the freedoms of the Swiss to a country which is really a hangover from the controlled Stalinist times. And I think it's inevitable that he would have carried with him features of his childhood and youth. And I think that's something that's burrowing away inside his mind, that maybe there's got to be a better way than this. And it probably is the fact that he wants to change it. But on the other hand, he certainly took part in the murder of his uncle, his aunt's husband, Jiang Song-taek, who was the second or third most powerful man in the land. And he also allegedly took part in the murder of his half-brother, Kim Jong-nam, at the Kuala Lumpur International Airport. So, you know, this isn't a man who is a complete lily-white convert who's come down and is in a state of shock about what he's found in North Korea. He's played by those rules, he's lived by those rules, but maybe he has come to the point of view, especially with a little help from the sanctions, that things have to change. One of the problems of the meeting that has just taken place is whether there will now be the will on the part of the Security Council and on the part of the members of the Security Council, and in particular China and the Russian Federation, to keep up the sanctions when peace has been declared. And this may well mean the removal of some of the sanctions, at least, and that will take away a lot of the pressure that Kim's been under that has led to these meetings.
Well, and undoubtedly that's one of the outcomes that he's looking for. Our guest is Michael Kirby, who led the UN Special Commission into North Korea and now watches on, as the rest of us do, with great interest. One of the preoccupations of this program, Justice Kirby, is the to look at life through the lens of faith and point to hope. Religious freedom is something that must feature, surely, in any way forward for North Korea. Do you think that there's a chance that they would ever give over their idea that, in fact, religion is to your religious fervour is for your supreme leader?
Well, it's true that the statements of universal human rights definitely include religion. They do include putting limits on religious observance for purposes of morality and the security of the state and so on, but nothing to explain the virtual suppression of religious freedom that we found existed in North Korea. Even on their own census statistics, Whereas in 1946, at the beginning of the separation of the two Koreas, the religious population of North Korea was approximately the same as of South Korea. In the census at around that time, the figure was virtually identical. It was about 24% of people in North Korea answered that they were Christian. But now, whilst that is about the same still in South Korea, in North Korea it was less than 1%. And that was put forward to us as proof that there had been a genocide of Christians in North Korea. And there was testimony before us of the great discouragement of religious observance, of the building and occupation of churches, except in Pyongyang, and of the suppression of religion as the opiate of the people, which is what Karl Marx called religion.
Right. Did you find compelling evidence of a genocide?
Well, in the end, we didn't find that we had enough evidence to reach a conclusion on that matter. We said that in due course, when North Korea becomes accessible, it will be possible to get testimony that explains why there's been this drop from 24 to less than 1% of the population. Is it simply because the state discourages religious observance and teaches that it's the opiate of the people, or is it because they've killed off religious observers? And certainly some of the escapees who made contact on the escape lines with religious organizations in South Korea that help in the escape of people from North Korea, that was a very, very bad factor. If they could prove that, if they found Bibles on them and prayer material and so on, then that could lead to a very severe punishment on their return to North Korea. And so there's no doubt there is great suppression of freedom of religion. Whether it amounts to genocide is something which we didn't feel comfortable on the evidence we have to decide whether it was simply discouragement, big discouragement, or whether it was actually killing people because of their faith.
But as with all of these other issues, must be weighed in the balance if there's to be a future. Well, Michael Kirby,
Mr. Trump did, by the way, mention religion in the press conference that followed the meeting in Singapore, and it does seem that he did raise that matter specifically. So that was one aspect of human rights. The only other aspect of human rights that seems to have been specifically raised was the return of the bodies of the missing in action and the prisoners of war, which is the human rights of people generally long since dead. And so it's been a neglected topic, and until it is addressed, there will be no peace on the Korean Peninsula.
Indeed. Just finally, Michael Kirby, I'd like to ask you to reflect for a moment on Cambodia. Now, you similarly, at the end of the Pol Pot regime, I well remember you led a commission of inquiry into Cambodia's future at that time. Now, that's some decades ago now. You've watched, and in fact, I think as a jurist, you helped to rebuild some of the apparatus of a justice system, elements of a civil society in Cambodia. But with the election that's due in that country shortly, the abolition of the opposition party, and now the suggestion by the opposition leader in exile that there ought to be a civil uprising after the election, how concerned should we be about Cambodia?
I think we should be greatly concerned about Cambodia, and particularly because the civil society is frightened. I met a person from Cambodia, a leader of civil society there last night, and she told me how checks are going to be made on whether you voted. There's no opposition party, and the UN Special Rapporteur, who is still responsible for human rights in Cambodia, has said that it's impossible to have a free and fair election if you have abolished the right of the opposition parties to participate. So they're checking to make sure everybody votes, and that is not with the aim of getting them to vote for the opposition, because the opposition won't be there, but just to turn up and cast a vote of some kind.
Which means they can then claim the mandate.
Yes, and I don't think we're going to see anything like the Malaysian surprise election results that happened last month. But it's a fairly grim story there. I seem to get all the hard, really hard issues from the United Nations, and neither North Korea nor Cambodia are really happy cases. They're not happy countries, and they've had really grim periods. In fact, you may remember from those faraway days, King Sihanouk used to go to North Korea for recuperation and treatment. And he had a connection with them. And but the role of China has greatly increased in Korea, and that
as
has
it has
not
in Cambodia.
Excellent. Yes, and in Cambodia, as you're right. And that has not been favourable to the situation of human rights in that country.
What a delicate world we live in. Thank you so much for your time. It's been enlightening speaking with you, and a delight to have you on the program. Thank you, Michael Kirby.
Thank you for having me.
Retired High Court Judge Michael Kirby, he led that UN Special Commission of Inquiry into Human Rights Abuses in North Korea. And there's a question as we move forward into, well, uncharted, not partly uncharted territory. And I say that because North Korea and the United States have been down this path a couple of times. It's often involved North Korea being able to get more foreign capital into its country and so on. But this time, let's hope it's a little bit more lasting than those previous two. But as we head down this pathway over the next 15 months or however long it takes to get denuclearization, will questions as important and profound and yet unstated as what about human rights crimes in North Korea? What about the question of referring those alleged crimes to the International Criminal Court? Will that question ever be asked rather than just here on Open House and in the minds of people like Michael Kirby? What role will the UN play? Does Donald Trump foresee the UN playing a role in the future? I hope he does. Surely he must. And in particular, if that could be a means of getting China and Russia on board with whatever is to happen on the Korean Peninsula, then that would be absolutely, absolutely crucial. But I don't think you can have a proper resolution of that situation without talking about a meaningful improvement for the people of North Korea, including that question, very central to my mind, of what happened to the Christians. Just to reiterate what Michael Kirby was saying, at the time when the Koreas split up, 24% of people roundabout identified as Christians. The number is about the same in South Korea now. And as we heard on a previous program, the Christians in South Korea, the Christian church is very strong. But the number that identifies Christians in North Korea now is about 1%. So where did those millions go? Where did they go? Did they just go underground, as it were? Were they killed, which is the suggestion the Kirby Commission heard, although they got no compelling evidence of it? So some important questions to go forward amidst all of the good things that are happening, undeniably, as a result of what happened when Donald Trump reached out and Kim Jong-un responded. And, you know, there are good things happening. I'm not going to be overly critical of that. But if it doesn't go to these other questions, then have we got the best we could get? That's a question. And on the Cambodian issue, there are elections in Cambodia in July, about a month from now. I think it's the 28th of July this year, a general election in Cambodia, the last being in 2013. Now, the result of that election was contested by what was the losing organisation, the opposition party. It boycotted the parliament, and a lot of water flowed under the bridge from then. But last year, the government had the courts deregister the opposition party. So there isn't an opposition party, or at least the main opposition party is not operating anymore in Cambodia. There are a few almost coalition partners, or they're certainly on the same side as the current ruling party. They can't mount an effective opposition, and it's not it's not in their terms of reference to do so to speak. So what sort of election will you have? Almost daily as we lead up to this election, there are new revelations coming out of Cambodia, which is a magnificent country and has had such a checkered past. This democracy itself was pulled together after Pol Pot was finally defeated, as you might know, and really only the last vestiges of the Khmer Rouge only really disappeared in the 1990s. And Michael Kirby himself was one of those who went in as an Australian representative to Cambodia in those early days and helped to restore the legal system and the other things that on which a civil society is based. So just in the last few days, there have been warnings that the police will arrest people if they think they're not voting, going into the booth and not voting. And they're saying that to not vote, they're saying that to encourage others not to vote is a crime. So compulsory voting, but if you encourage others to boycott the election, it's a crime. And then they say that if you're doing that in a way, if you're doing that yourself in a way that encourages others, you might be arrested for that. And they've also said, because their system of marking off whether you've enrolled or not is to ink your finger. Inking your finger is part of the process of voting in a Cambodian election. If you ink your finger but haven't voted, that will also be considered an offence. Very delicate situation in Cambodia, a place many of us care about a great deal.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.